This is KTOO-FM in Juneau. Decreasing clouds for the rest of today, but for Thursday and Friday, it will be cloudy again with scattered showers. Juneau Afternoon is next. We'll learn about this weekend's Oyster Fest with guest Sean Blumenschein. We'll get a preview of this weekend's concerts by pianist Richard Dowling. Details about this weekend's enrollment day at UAS is also on tap, and an update on 360 North TV with Tim Olson. That, Writer's Almanac, music and more, that's next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Chief Oliver Red Cloud from the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota is being remembered. He died last week in Colorado. Services are being held this week in South Dakota for the 93-year-old. He's a fourth-generation descendant of Warrior Chief Red Cloud. Victoria Wicks has more.
After distinguishing himself as a warrior against other bands and then the U.S. Army, Red Cloud became chief of the Oglala Band in 1868, the same year he signed the Fort Laramie Treaty. About 111 years later, his great-great-grandson, Oliver Red Cloud, became chief of the Oglala people, and as chief, he fought to keep his ancestors' treaty alive. A distinguished leader from the Cheyenne River Band, Arvel Looking Horse, says Oliver Red Cloud inherited the duty to protect the treaty.
In our tradition, everybody has their place and what they're allowed to speak about. You have to earn that right to speak on behalf of our people. Mr. Red Cloud, he's always talked about that, in the treaty.
Looking Horse is the 19th generation keeper of the chanupa, or pipe bundle, brought to the people by White Buffalo Calf Woman. He says he has accepted the request to be a pallbearer for Red Cloud. A member of the Oglala Sioux tribe, Richard Moves Camp, says Oliver Red Cloud was a conscientious leader.
Oliver was continuing to remind the people that they are a proud nation, and also he was really instrumental to remind the government of its obligations to help the Lakota people through obligations on the treaties and the international law.
Moves Camp says one of the obligations of the chief is to train his replacement. Although a new chief has not been named, Moves Camp says he expects that to happen. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The case of a child at the center of a custody dispute that went to the U.S. Supreme Court has another complication. As KGOU's Kirk Wartney reports, the girl's biological father, who's Cherokee, has now filed for adoption.
Dustin Brown and other relatives of 3-year-old Veronica filed court papers in Oklahoma Monday to adopt the child. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled last month South Carolina courts should decide who gets to adopt Veronica. The South Carolina courts originally said the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act favored her living with her Cherokee father. Brown took custody in 2011, moving Veronica to Oklahoma. Matt and Melanie Capabianco of James Island, South Carolina, who raised Veronica for the first 27 months of her life, appealed that decision. The Post and Courier newspaper of Charleston reports their attorney says the filing for adoption in Oklahoma will further delay South Carolina proceedings. The Cherokee Nation has said it will support the Brown family in its pursuit of custody. Court filings show that Brown's parents have also asked the Cherokee Nation court to give them the chance to adopt the child under the Indian Child Welfare Act. The couple is already a certified placement family for the tribe. The little girl's mother has said she still wants the Capabiancos to raise her daughter. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
The flag of the First People of Australia is flying overseas at a military base. According to news reports, this is the first time the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flag is flying at an overseas base. It was raised at a ceremony in the United Arab Emirates to recognize Aboriginal military members and to join in on week-long celebrations taking place in Australia that recognize Aboriginal people's history, culture, and achievements. During this week in 2012, then U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar and Taos Pueblo leaders signed 3 water contracts to settle a long-standing water rights case in New Mexico. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time 3.5-year online Master of Social Work program emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. Learn more at humboldt.edu/socialwork. Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is seeking to fill two positions in our national studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We are accepting applications for a senior producer for Native America Calling and resource development specialist to sell underwriting. Full job descriptions can be found at nativeamericacalling.com. Click on employment.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Good afternoon and welcome to Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. On the board is Jeff Brown. We have some exciting guests this afternoon, and our first guests include Elena Peterson and Sean Blumenshine. They are from Ha'ani, which is a subsidiary of Sea Alaska, our regional native corporation for Southeast Alaska. It's a for-profit corporation, as is the Ha'ani subsidiary. Elaine is the economic development coordinator for Ha'ani, I know I can say it, and Sean is the office administrator, and they're here to tell us about two events coming up this weekend, each with a different purpose.
Right.
And one is Friday and one is Saturday. Why don't we just start with Friday? What's happening Friday?
Okay, well, Friday starts with our dinner, which is called the Cufflinks and Pearls Gala, and it's a full event with a big schedule of happenings. We're going to it's located at the tram, Mount Roberts Tram, and it starts at 5:30. And there's two types of tickets. There's VIP and general admission. And the VIP events will start at 5:30 with a cocktail hour up the tram at the restaurant. And this is going to feature the oysters that come from Yakutat, from our local oyster farmers, and some great beer and cocktails. And then
a martini bar.
Oh, yes, a martini bar. And then we move on to a performance starting at 6:30, and that's when general admission will join. And there's also going to be a silent auction. And after the performance, which features a local Native dance group and Brooke
Leslie.
Leslie, yes.
From Wrangell.
Yes, she's a great, actually she's a shareholder, Sea Alaska, and she's a great singer. And after the performance, then everyone will come back to the silent auction to have some hors d'oeuvres and appetizers and then start the dinner at about 7 o'clock. And then the event ends with a dessert auction, and that's going to be a lot of fun as well, so.
We have a four-course meal that's being prepared by Sandy Ingberg, who is from the Grand Central Oyster Bar and Restaurant in New York City. Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute brought him up for us for this event and for the Oyster Fest. So he prepared the menu, and Alaskan Brewery is pairing one of their beers with each course.
That sounds fantastic. What are the four courses, Sean? Do you know?
I don't have that off the top of my head.
Okay.
I know there's a fish and chips. He's worked with, it's all Alaskan seafood, of course. So he's working with black cod, of course, our oysters. He's got some crab in there. And he's got a good variety, actually. There's even some pulque. And so he worked with Alaska Seafood Marketing closely on making sure that it was, like, relevant seafood for the area.
Very good. What are the ticket costs, Elena? You mentioned two levels, VIP, which is 5:30 with the cocktail hour, mm-hmm. and then general admission in time for the performance at 6:30. What are the ticket costs, and do they include the ride up and down on the tram?
Yeah, great question. The VIP is $165, and the general admission is $125, and they both include everything, the tram ride all the way up. Actually, the VIP also includes valet parking, and then the cocktail hours, and then the performance, the meal, and at the dinner, the beer pairing
as
is
well.
Included,
mm-hmm.
And all the way through to the dessert auction, which is going to be a fun event. It's where people, each table gets to bid on their desserts, and the table that wins gets to choose their dessert first. And so, yeah, it's all inclusive, and everyone walks home with a goodie bag.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Now, tell me a little bit about the purpose of the Pearls and Cufflinks event. Is this just for fun? Is it to raise funds for something?
Yeah,
it is. It's a fundraiser for our community development financial institution. So we work for Hani, which is a subsidiary of Sea Alaska, as you mentioned. And Hani created a separate standalone nonprofit entity called the Hani Community Development Fund. And its purpose is small business loan deployment around Southeast Alaska. So its target area is all of Southeast. All the funds that are raised at this event will go towards the Community Development Fund. So it'll help increase our loan capacity and help, you know, actually currently the nonprofit doesn't have any staff. All of our time is donated to running it. So eventually we want to raise enough money to actually hire somebody.
Sure. So, Elena, your job at Ha'ani is the Economic Development Coordinator. Can you give us some examples of the types of enterprises that would be supported or have been supported from these type of fundraisers?
Yeah, for the Community Development Fund, we're specifically looking to support small businesses that are coming out of rural communities that would help support and foster economic growth in the rural communities that are seeing a lot of out-migration and have some struggles with their economy. And so we're focusing on making available capital for loans for businesses that would help spur the economy in those areas.
Are these primarily what might be called microloans?
Might be called, yeah, microfinancing.
Like 5,000, 10,000, meaning relatively small compared
yeah,
to a large capitalization
right,
project.
We mm-hmm, have two levels of loans, actually, 1,000 to 250. 25,000,
right,
and then 25 up to 250,000.
And does Ha'ani already have a number of these loans out to support rural businesses, or is this a new venture of your nonprofit?
This is brand new. So we've been established since 2012, and we have one loan out currently to a young woman in Hoona who opened a restaurant called the Chipperfish, and it's great. I've eaten there.
Oh my gosh,
it was
right,
amazing.
She does really good work.
And she does really good work, and yeah, she started this business, and it's doing great in Hoona. And so those are the types of things we're hoping to continue and fund and help people open businesses and create jobs.
We are looking at increasing our loan capacity so that we could do the larger loans, further down the road.
Elena, how would a loan from Ha'ani be more attractive to an applicant than a regular commercial loan? For example, is the interest rate forgiven? Is it particularly low? Is there...
That's a great question. And yeah, we're trying to make it accessible to people that don't have access to traditional financing. So they may not qualify for a loan through a bank or another financial institute. Interest rates are generally lower than what you would find at a bank. And the requirements for getting the loan are maybe not as strict as a bank or another financial institute. So we make it a lot easier for these smaller rural community or entrepreneurs to get a loan to start their small business. And we give them the capacity and support that they need to make sure it's successful.
Well, let's talk about the second event then. That's the Oyster Fest.
Right.
Second annual. The first one I saw was this last, a year ago at Celebration.
That's right.
In fact, it was right downtown, as I recall.
That's exactly right.
So it must have been successful or you wouldn't repeat it, I assume.
Right. It last year's was crazy. Definitely for sure. It was last year it was planned in a very short period of time. It was 3 days, because Celebration is 3 days. And this year we decided to knock it down to 1 day. We kind of counted as 2 days if you count our fundraiser the night before, because just as much planning goes into that as the Oyster Fest. And so we did definitely learn a lot last year. We had, for the weather, especially since the weather did not cooperate with us last year, we had quite a good turnout. So we did decide to do it again this year and take some of our lessons learned from last year and apply them to this year.
What will that look like then, Sean? Will it? How can folks get connected with it, and will it be an all-day event?
Well, it is. It does go from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. So it is pretty much all day. Again, it's the same hours as we had last year. This year we do have a beer garden, which we did not have last year. Thank you to Alaskan Brewery. That will run from noon to 7. And what we're doing this year, we're selling oysters in the half dozen and dozen. So a half dozen is $12 and a dozen is $20. We do have an all-you-can-eat oyster crawl that will go from 7 to 9 with our participating restaurants. And right now our participating restaurants are the Prospector, Zen, and Rockwell's.
Okay.
And then, of course, us.
So how, if somebody wanted to participate in Oyster Fest, where do they start? Do they buy a ticket somewhere and then go to any of the restaurants? Is there a central place where the beer garden will be?
There is a central location where the beer garden will be. So
okay.
It's going to take place in the Sea Alaska parking lot. And we are that's going to be the main event, is definitely at the parking lot this year. Last year, we were kind of all over the place, which just logistically was a lot, especially for 3 days. So this year, we're concentrating all of our efforts really on our parking lot. And we're going to have entertainment. We've got a DJ that will be providing music again this year. We are going to have the Bouncy House will be there. Alaska Seafood Marketing is going to have a photo op. We've got Icy Straight Point, who's going to do grilled oysters again this year. They did last year, and they're a big hit. We'll have our own raw bar. And then Chef Sandy Ingberg from Grand Central Oyster Bar in New York will also have a booth right next to the beer garden that will be providing oysters as well.
Sounds like you might have this in a tent or something.
There'll be tents, absolutely.
I wonder the weather is so unpredictable.
Yeah.
Or it is predictable, which is you can't count on it.
Exactly.
So, now, the proceeds from this, is this just a fun event being offered?
This is really to grow awareness of the Alaskan oyster and to try and grow that industry. One of the things that we do in our economic development arm is try to find lifestyle compatible ways for our village people to earn income, and oyster farming is one that is compatible with that lifestyle.
Of course. And where will the oysters be coming from? We mentioned Yakutat before.
There are other sources. So Yakutat is our primary source. It's got the largest and most oysters available currently. We're working on getting Angoon online. We are working on a project in Hoonah, and we're also working on one in Prince of Wales. And now those are just the ones specifically in Southeast, but there are a few other oyster farms outside of Southeast around Alaska. And we source them when we need. There's a little bit of a network going on, so like we help each other out.
Sure, you would need to, depending on availability.
Right.
So if folks wanted tickets for one or both of the events for this weekend, can they go online, or how do they access
the
tickets?
For the Cufflinks and Pearls, they should contact me directly.
Okay.
Which my number is 586-9251. Or my email address is sean.blumenshine@sealaska.com.
Sean, spell your first and last name.
SHAWN.BLUMENSHINE. It is a mouthful.
Okay. You can also look at our Facebook page.
All right.
We have a Facebook page which talks all about it, so look up Ha Ani on Facebook, and you can find out about the events there as well.
Spell that, Elena.
Ha Ani is HAAANI.
It's a lot of A's.
Yeah.
It is.
HAAANI.
And it's two words. Ha and then
Ani.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Elena Peterson and Sean Blumenshine of Ha Ani, which is a subsidiary of the Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation here. Two events are happening this weekend. On Friday, Cufflinks and Pearls. There are two levels of tickets. The VIP is $165, general admission, which includes music and a meal, and the dessert auction is at $125. The VIP event, which is a cocktail party, starts at 5:30, and the general admission begins at 6:30 on the tram, and the tickets, of course, include the transportation up and down the tram. On Saturday, from 11 to 9 is the Oyster Fest. Look for that event in the parking lot of Sea Alaska, downtown here. It will include a beer garden from noon to 7 and an oyster crawl, love the term, from 7 to 9 that evening amongst three participating restaurants. You can look at their Facebook page, HAAANI, thank you, or give Sean a call at 586-9251, or Sean, that's SHAWN.Blumenshine@SeaAlaska.com. www.alaskanseafoodcorp.com. Thanks for your time today. Good luck with the events this weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, and our producer today is Jeff Brown. Our next guest is Richard Dowling. He is a pianist. He's performed here before and many times, apparently, and he is about to perform again. He has a program this Friday and Saturday evening at 7:30 at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church, and then the second night at Northern Light United Church, which is downtown on B Street. Richard, I found the program very interesting. You have quite a combination of Chopin, Joplin, Gershwin, and more. That is a mixed bag, as it were. Talk to me a little bit about how your varied interests developed in these three very distinct types of genres.
Well, I guess for all classical pianists, the music of Frédéric Chopin is probably their number one favorite composer. Every classical pianist loves Chopin, and the public is still in love with Chopin. I mean, when you advertise his works, you'll get people to come to a classical recital that don't even think that they like classical music because his tunes are so beautiful and so memorable. So that's my first love. But when I grew up in Houston, Texas, we were a three-piano family. I grew up taking lessons on my aunt's old upright, and then I guess by the time I was about 12, I didn't ask for, I demanded a grand piano. And in the process of acquiring a baby grand, we also located an old 1914 Aeolian pump player piano. So that's how we became a three-piano family. And so I started collecting hundreds of rolls. And as a 12-year-old, through musical osmosis, learned about American popular music from 1890 to about 1930 by playing along with and pumping those player piano rolls. Sometimes my sister, my mother, father would get on the player piano and pump it, and then I would be on one of the other pianos playing along, doing dueling pianos. And, you know, when you're a kid and things are fun and you're self-motivated, that's when you learn the best, because you're not taking lessons. You're just doing it on your own. So I fell in love with this music. And, of course, it occurred right at the nexus of interest in the resurgence of ragtime. It was, I think, 1974 was the year that The Sting won the Academy Award for Best Picture, featuring Robert Redford and Paul Newman. And that the music in that movie was put together by Marvin Hamlisch, who died recently, wonderful pianist and composer and conductor. And even though the time frame of the movie was a little off, it was like a 1930s gangster movie, The music of ragtime is really from the 1900s and 1910s, but people didn't know that, and it became an enormous hit. And, of course, what we know is The Entertainer by Scott Joplin, his famous tune. A lot of people call it The Sting, because that was the main tune in the movie The Sting. So I'll be playing that on Friday and Saturday night, The Entertainer.
So identifiable.
It's so identifiable. And a couple of other Joplin tunes that were also used in The Sting that people will recognize. So in my particular opinion, and I think people are starting to agree with me more and more, when I say people, I mean my fellow musicians, I consider this to be classical music. It's America's classical music, because it's now 100 years old, the height of, or as we say in Texas, the height. The height of ragtime was really between 1910 and 1915. So we were right now 100 year, ragtime is exactly 100 years old. And I think when something is 100 years old, we deem it a classic. So this is really not that bizarre of a program. We've got Frédéric Chopin's music, which has endured for, you know, more than 150 years. And we have ragtime music, which has endured for 100 years. And, you know, when ragtime was first composed, it was composed as background music for saloons and houses of ill repute. And so its pedigree was kind of tarnished right from the beginning. But because that's all changed in the past 100 years, people don't listen to ragtime in saloons or in houses of ill repute anymore, we can just take the music on its own terms. And it was a huge success right from the very beginning because of the syncopation. That's what still drives it. Popular music today, Lady Gaga, Madonna, all popular music has the same exact syncopation that ragtime has. And ragtime was really the beginning of the separation of classical music from popular music. America invented popular music, and now the divide that we have today between rock and roll and classical music is because of ragtime. I mean, prior to ragtime, there wasn't any term classical music. There were really just four kinds of music in the world. There was concert music, there was patriotic and folk music, and then, of course, we had sacred music, church music. And so those four kinds of music were all that we had. There wasn't any really popular music in the sense of thinking about Elvis Presley or Buddy Holly or Madonna or the Beatles or something like that. There wasn't. I mean, classical music was the popular music.
The greatest hits of 1750,
right,
or 1850.
Mozart was the Lady Gaga
exactly.
of the day, you know.
So, Richard, are you also going to play at the theater this time? When you were in Juneau, wasn't it Juneau Jazz and Classics?
During Jazz
you were
and
just
Classics.
Recently here.
Yep.
You played for a silent film, is that correct? And when you mentioned the House of Ill Repute and saloons, and it made me think, yes, but weren't movies part of that as well? And is that going to be part of your visit this time to Juneau?
It is. I contacted Colette Costa at the Goldtown Nickelodeon, and on Tuesday night we're going to have two movies that I'm going to reprise my role as being in the driver's seat on the old upright piano. It was a lot of fun 2 months ago, and so I called Colette. You know, I'm here in Juneau thanks to Barbara Wilmot. This is all her doing. She's our local impresario and music lover extraordinaire. And she's made these concerts come to pass. So I called Colette because she told me when I was here in May, she said, if you ever come back to Juneau, let me know. And so I called Colette and I said, hey, I'm coming back. She said, already? So we're going to do it again. It's two Harold Lloyd films, Safety Last, and the other one I think is called Girl Crazy or something like that. And it's going to be a lot of fun. I'll be playing ragtime tunes and sappy old romantic ditties, you know, when the damsel in distress is being tied to the railroad track, you know, I sort of pump up the volume a little bit, and when they start smooching, then I get out the old sappy music. And
True drama.
That's it.
Now, one of your goals as a musician is to bring live classical music to audiences across America. In today's world, don't audiences have access to classical music via the internet? In other words, what corners have you yet to reach and Why are you still passionate about that?
Well, I've been on the program with Jeff here when I've been in town with my cellist friend, Evan Drachman, and you're speaking about the Piatigorsky Foundation, of which Paul and Linda Rosenthal, the violinists here in town, and I are all members of this Piatigorsky Foundation. And what we do is we travel the country, 22, maybe 23 states now. We've just added Tennessee to our repertoire. We go and we play in smaller venues. We can play in a big city at a retirement community where the people in that community can't get out at night or don't want to go out at night to hear the symphony or the opera or even just a recital. And then in little towns, we particularly play in a lot of schools because those schools don't have any access to live music, certainly not at our level. I mean, I'm breaking my arm, patting my back here, but I mean, I've performed in Hewlett, Wyoming, which is where Devil's Tower National Monument is located, in the far northeastern corner of Wyoming. And people there still email me after 2 or 3 years saying, when are you coming back? The entire town came to the school gymnasium to hear the concert because they don't have any music. Live music is the difference.
So the difference is live music.
Right.
One of your reviews said that you are a musician with something to say. What is it you're trying to say? What kind of transformation do you believe that live music can be a catalyst for?
It's funny you bring that up because Barbara and I were just talking about that today over lunch. There's something visceral about going to a live concert. As much as I love recordings, they just can't replace the live experience of getting goosebumps. You're not going to sit at home with candles and a glass of wine with the lights down low, staring at your stereo speakers with it turned up loud enough to be the equivalent of live music and sit there and let the music flow over you and get goosebumps. But you'll do that when you go to a live concert, maybe without the wine, which is too bad. But just the experience, and there's also something to be said about a group of people coming together, and I can prove this by when a new movie comes out, everybody, especially if it's a hit, everybody wants to see it, and the theater's packed. And so when you go to a packed movie theater, the movie's much more exciting than if you wait 3 or 4 weeks and you go to the theater and you're the only person there for the 3 o'clock matinee. It just doesn't have the same punch. People like a group experience somehow together. It just has an indescribable quality to it.
And what do you hope it is that your music is saying?
Well, again, as I was speaking to Barbara today, I'm just the conduit. Unlike a painting which can hang on the wall that we can perceive with our eyes, we have a direct communication with the artist or the photographer. With music, you can't pin the sheet music up to the wall and stare at it and get anything out of it. It requires a performer to recreate the composer's inspiration. And so it's just as much, I get just as much out of it as the audience does, because I'm sort of the filter through which Chopin and Gershwin and Joplin can come to life once again. It's not, I didn't compose it, but they can't live without me either. It's music is a weird art. It's because it's temporal and it has to be done over and over and over again. That's why if you love Elvis, you know, you didn't just go to one of his concerts. You went to as many as you could go to. You just wanted to have that experience over and over. If you have a favorite meal at a favorite restaurant, you just keep going back to that restaurant because you just love the way they cook that particular meal, you know?
So I understand that you have an affinity for French music, French art, French culture. And I wondered what it meant that you have been inducted as a Chevalier of the renowned company of musketeers, Armagnac, which is an honor society founded in the 17th century by D'Artagnan. What is that, and how did this affinity grow? I need to know about your, it sounds like you're the knight of the musketeers or something, as curious.
Yeah, unfortunately, TSA won't let me bring my sword on the airplane. but I do have a nice, what did you call it, banner, a bright blue banner that I can wear with a big medallion. I grew up in Houston, as I mentioned, and I've done my best to get rid of my Texas accent, but I grew up speaking French because of my next-door neighbors, being from France. You know, Houston's an oil town, so we have people from all over the world. All the world's biggest oil companies have headquarters in Houston. And so I learned to speak French as a little kid instead of Spanish, which is kind of odd. And now, you know, so ever since I've been in college, I've been going to France. I studied there for a couple of years, and I have a lot of friends in France, and I've gotten to perform there a lot. And so over the years, I've done a lot of charity concerts to help restore old churches. And so part of that charity work, I was recognized and inducted into this honor society. And it's a nice little thing. It impresses the hell out of fellow Americans. And, you know, when I go to France, I purposely add my Texas accent back onto my French because it drives them nuts.
So I just want to know, where do you wear the blue sash and the medallion? Cocktail parties or?
You know, I've worn it a couple of times when I've played really formal concerts in New York with white tie and tails. You know, everybody likes to be a little bit of a show-off. And that's one way I can be a little different because, you know, I don't have long hair or a beard or whatever, you know, trying to look like a typical classical musician. So that gives me something a little different.
You're
to
a
do.
Chevalier, and that's a unique
there
distinction.
You go.
Richard, how much are the tickets for the concerts on Friday and Saturday?
$25 for adults.
Okay.
Then there's a concession for seniors. I believe it's $20.
Okay.
And students, $10.
All right. Very
and,
good.
And they're available on the Juno Arts and Humanities Council website, the JAHC.org website.
Very good. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. We're talking with Richard Dowling, pianist who will perform Friday night at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church out in the Valley and Saturday night at Northern Light United Church on B Street in downtown Juno. 7:30 both evenings. Tickets for adults are $25 and available on the JAC website. And if you're interested in the accompaniment with a silent film and the drama that's associated with that, you can join Richard and friends at the Gold Town Nickelodeon Theater Tuesday evening. I assume it's probably around 7 o'clock.
Seven, yeah, just ask Colette. She knows everything.
She does indeed.
She does.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Richard.
Always.
Appreciate you joining us. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Laurie Scantling with producer Jeff Brown. Our next guest is Amanda Triplett, and we are going to be talking about enrollment day at UAS. It is Friday from 10 to 4. What do people need to know, and can everything happen in one day?
Well, yes, everything can happen in one day, but it doesn't have to. So we really encourage students or prospective students to come out to campus. They can talk with an academic advisor about their potential fall class schedule. They can talk with our financial aid advisors, get all of their FAFSA forms taken care of. They can take their placement tests to see what level of math and English they can go into. And this enrollment day, we're actually going to have a little barbecue starting at noon. So you can definitely come down earlier, but starting at noon, we're going to fire up the grill and we're going to have some good eats as well.
Nice. Let's talk a little bit more in depth about the financial aid part. Lots of headlines about the expense of college. Certainly going to a school in your hometown or your home state is much more affordable, and there are a number of sources to assist. Clarify what the FAFSA is for folks and what other sources that students can be guided to access to support the cost of their higher education.
Yeah, so definitely going to college anywhere is expensive, even at like the local hometown, because it's an investment and it's definitely something that you have to plan for. But the FAFSA stands for Free Application for Federal Student Aid, and it's something that the student and that student's parent or guardian will fill out with them with their tax information. And from there, you can see if you can qualify for Pell Grant and also Stafford loans. So if students do, in fact, need to take out loans and they missed the deadline for scholarships, those are the steps that they can take. So, and if it's their first time filling it out, some parents and families might be a little hesitant because they say they don't qualify, but it's not if you qualify or not. It's just the step that every student has to take for certain types of financial aid.
So this is the omnibus form nationally that all potential college students should fill out in order to get, as I recall, kind of a rating of what you could qualify for.
Yes, that is correct.
Great. So it's a great entry level kind of application before you begin anything.
Yeah, definitely. And an enrollment day, you know, in the past, it's been, you know, sometimes students try and get everything taken care of at one time, and that can be really stressful for students and for parents. And so please don't feel like you need to come down and do everything. If you just want to come down and take your time and review the placement test material, that way you can be really successful in that area first, that's fine. And just also remember that our campus is open Monday through Friday, so students don't have to wait to do these things until enrollment day. We encourage you to come out to campus anytime and meet with our financial aid advisors, take the placement tests, and apply for admissions.
When do fall classes start at UAS?
Yeah, so fall classes are coming up. They start on September 3rd.
And what is the drop-dead day to apply if you want to start taking classes this fall?
So the last day to apply for admissions for the fall 2013 semester is August 1st.
So that's not that far away.
It is not. It's less than a month away.
And is UAS an open admissions college, or are there GPAs and SATs and the other acronyms that students need to be aware of in order to be admitted?
That's a great question. We are an open enrollment university, so any person, we encourage them to come to our university and try to meet our academic requirements. So if you just wanted to come and take an art class, you can definitely do that. You don't have to be in a degree program. However, we do have GPA requirements. We do require either an ACT or SAT requirement for students coming into our baccalaureate degree programs. And we're going to start to see a shift of those degree requirements aligning with the Alaska Performance Scholarship.
Maybe you could explain a little bit for folks who might not know what the Alaska Performance Scholarship is.
Yeah, so the Alaska Performance Scholarship, also known as like the Governor's Performance Scholarship, it's a scholarship that's available to high school seniors if they're meeting all of the curriculum requirements. And it encourages students while they're in high school starting their freshman year to take a rigorous high school curriculum. And there's different tracks that students can take. So like, for example, 4 years of English, 4 years of math, 2 years of a foreign language. And in addition to that rigorous high school curriculum, it takes into account their cumulative GPA and either their ACT, SAT, or work keys test score. And if you come in at certain levels, either level 1, 2, or 3, you can automatically qualify for certain types of funding in the University of Alaska System Schools.
I assume the academic advisors would be sitting down with potential applicants to help them assess their alignment with, as you say, the Alaska Performance Scholarship is an automatic award system if those academic requirements are met. So students will have some guidance on that, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. We can definitely help you with that, or if you have other types of you know, scholarship questions or you're just not even sure where to start, coming out to campus is definitely the step in the right direction.
Now, what if in Alaska there is the high stakes exit exam with the three parts required for graduation, reading, writing, and math? What if a student has achieved all the credits at their Alaska school, but they didn't pass all three parts of the so-called exit exam? What status is that individual?
So unfortunately, if they don't pass all of the steps of the exit exam, technically they don't receive
a full diploma.
A full diploma. Therefore, you know, they don't qualify to meet our application requirements for our baccalaureate degree programs because it's either GED, a high school diploma, or taking potentially like 30 credits somewhere else. So at another university, so they wouldn't qualify, unfortunately.
So there are some thresholds that
Definitely.
Have to be met to be considered a high school graduate or a GED graduate. Then.
Definitely.
And what other services could students access on Thursday? For example, housing. Could they sign up for housing?
Yes, they definitely can sign up for housing. We'll also, you can initiate disability services as well. So for lots of students, maybe they had an IEP in high school and they want to see how those services translate into university at UAS and what kind of accommodations they can receive. You can start that conversation on Thursday with our disability services coordinator, Margie Thompson. We will also have not only financial aid and placement testing, but we have other resources available if you're interested in going on academic exchange. So where you're at our university for 1 year, you're a UAS student, and then maybe you're looking to go to Hawaii or Australia or do another type of exchange in another state, you can look at those options, and we can provide you some really cool information on that.
If there are listeners who are kind of on the fence about the next step in their education, what's one thing you would say to them about UAS to convince them that it would be a good choice?
Just from my own personal experience, no matter what your circumstance is, I think UAS has a lot to offer each individual person, whether you're looking to complete your degree that you stopped out like 10 years ago due to life happening, or if you're just starting to pursue a degree. There's so many different options, and there's a lot of flexibility in your own schedule and the time frame that you want to get your degree and your goals. So whether it's nighttime classes or distance delivery programs, UAS can offer all of that. So just coming out and starting the initial conversation with either one of our advisors or calling our admissions line, I think, is a step in the right direction.
What's the admissions line?
So the telephone number that folks can call for information about enrollment day or just general information is 796-6000.
And where would folks find you on Friday or find at least the barbecue lit
up
at noon?
So you can follow your noses to the barbecue, but we'll actually be in the bottom floor of the Egan Building and the Learning and Testing Center.
So that's the library. Folks
mm-hmm.
might know that as
yep.
the library. And is that where folks would look for the admissions staff on other days of the week as well?
Nope. We, on enrollment day, it's kind of a special day because we bring all of our forces together and bundle them in one nice room for everyone. But typically, we are more spread out on our campus if they would stop by a regular Monday through Friday.
All right. We're talking with Amanda Triplett about enrollment day at UAS this Friday from 10 to 4 at the Egan Center. For more information, you can call 796-6000. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, July 10th, 2013. It's the birthday of a man whose entire reputation is built on one novel more than 3,000 pages long, Marcel Proust. Born in France in 1871, his parents were well off, his father a respected doctor, but Marcel was a sickly child prone to asthma attacks, and he was in and out of school. He continued to live with his parents and his brother in their apartment, but when his parents died, he began to write, supported by a large inheritance left him by his mother, and he spent the rest of his life working on The Remembrance of Things Past, which is sometimes titled In Search of Lost Time. It's the birthday of the short story writer Alice Munro, born in Wingham, Ontario, in 1931. She grew up on a farm, and she said reading was an indulgence that you didn't go in for if there was physical work to be done. women were only supposed to read on Sundays because on every other day of the week they had no excuse to be reading when they could be knitting instead. It's the birthday of British writer Edmund Clarihugh Bentley, born in London in 1875. He wrote lots of detective fiction that reversed the usual conventions of the genre. Bentley is better known as the inventor of a new form of verse, the Clarihugh. The Clarihugh, made up of two rhyming couplets, the first rhyme provided by the name of a famous person. For example, George III ought never to have occurred. One can only wonder at so grotesque a blunder. It's the birthday of theologian John Calvin, a leader of the Protestant Reformation, born in Noyon, France, in 1509. His teachings form the basis of the Presbyterian and Reformed churches. He studied for the priesthood, but as Martin Luther's ideas spread to France, Calvin became uneasy about his Catholicism. When he was 22, he experienced a conversion in which he felt that God had called him to forsake the Catholic Church. He went to Switzerland and wrote Institutes of the Christian Religion, and it became a rallying point for Protestants all over Europe. And here is a poem by Carol Ann Duffy, Midsummer Night. Not there to see midsummer's midnight rose open and bloom, me, nor there when the river dressed in turquoise under the moon, you, not there when stone softened open showed the fossils they held, or there, us, when the dark sky fell to the earth to gather its smell. Not there when a strange bird sang on a branch over our heads, you and me, or there when a starlit fruit ripened itself on a tree, not there to lie on the grass of our graves, both alive, alive, oh, or there for Shakespeare's shooting star, or for who we are, but elsewhere, far, not there for the magic hour when time becomes love, or there for light's pale hand to slip slender from darkness's glove, not there when our young ghosts called to us from the other side, or there where the heron's rags were a silver gown by grace of the light, not there to be right, to find our souls, we dropped silks on the ground, or there to be found again by ourselves, you, me, mirrored in water, not there to see constellations spell themselves on the sky and black rhyme with white, or there to see petals fold on a rose like a kiss on Midsummer Night. Midsummer Night, a poem by Carol Ann Duffy from her collection Rapture, published by Faber and Faber, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. This is Billy Collins, hoping you will join us next time here on the Writer's Almanac.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Laurie Scandling, and our producer today is Jeff Brown. My last guest this afternoon is Tim Olson. He is a programmer for 360 North and KTOO Television. Tim, tell us a little bit about Alaska programs that are coming up on 360 North, specifically about our state.
Yeah, I like to come by every once in a while and remind people that we have some pretty interesting programming that's specifically designed to be for an Alaska audience. That's sort of what 360 North does. And some of it's sort of different. Tonight, there is a very interesting documentary on that is being broadcast on 360 North. It was broadcast once before last winter, but we're the first television station to air it. It was produced by students from the Kenny Lake School and the Copper River School District. They have done three documentaries over the last years. There's a faculty member there, Ray Voley, who's done great work with students doing productions, and they've created a documentary that's on tonight at 8, Bonanza, the Story of Kennecott. It's an hour and a half feature film about the history of Kennecott and the mining and the whole region around where they live there. It's very well done. It's quirky and funny, and it's done from the perspective of high school age students. And it really is enjoyable to watch. They do some recreations. They have a lot of wonderful archival material, and it's very creatively done, and it's done in as a perspective of a young person. And next week there'll be another Kenny Lake historical documentary on Wednesday night. So those are very popular. I wanted to bring that up. Every night of the week we have Alaska programming on 360 North Television, and we broadcast it around the state. For instance, on Monday nights, people might not know that we have Science for Alaska on Monday nights. It's a relationship that we have with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and those lectures are presented by professors and distinguished scientists from around the state. It's part of that traveling series that goes around the state. We get them recorded, and we put them on television. Friday nights, we switch back and forth between Egan lectures from the University of Alaska Southeast and other public affairs programming that's geared towards Alaska audience, the Juneau World Affairs Council. We record those presentations when they have world-class speakers in town, and there's an Alaska audience asking questions about how the topic that they're speaking on relates to Alaskans. So there's every night of the week great programming about Alaska on 360 North. This week, those are three examples of Monday night. There was a great Science for Alaska, and there will be one on next Monday night. Tonight, Bonanza, the story of Kennecott, produced by young people with the help of their community members. It's very well done and really fun to watch. And every Friday night as well, we have a different lecture or presentation by Alaskans or made specifically for Alaskans. So it's just an example of the Alaska programming that we do.
I know one of the exciting projects that has taken lots of energy around here has been the four-part television production regarding the Alaska Marine Highway System.
Yeah.
Now, the first part's done, is that right?
The first part aired throughout Alaska and then went into national distribution recently. So the anniversary's been ongoing throughout this calendar year of 2013. So we aired a program that included a lot of the history and a lot about the Marine Highway and the 50th anniversary early in the year. And now we have three other programs coming out soon. The four shows are going to air as a series throughout Alaska on 360 North, starting at the end of September. We're still kind of like putting the final touches on the broadcast dates. So there'll be the four-part series of 4 one-hour documentaries about the Marine Highway and this 50th anniversary and the history and great stories from people who were involved in it 50 years ago and people today that use the Marine Highway to get around from various community to community, from, you know, as far as Metlakatla to the Aleutians. So interesting stories there. The first program went into national distribution recently, and it's been very popular in just the first weeks that it's been in distribution. It's already shown in 20 states besides Alaska. Huge broadcast areas. It aired on the East Coast night before last in Washington, D.C., and the state of Maryland Public Television. We heard some things. We got some phone calls from that area. It airs tonight, I think. I wrote some things down here because it's something every day, different broadcasts. Tonight it's in... last night it was Minneapolis. Tomorrow it's in Indianapolis. All the Appalachians are airing it, evidently, but we're getting great coverage. Over 24 million television households have had access to that program that we produced here in Juneau, so we're getting a lot of great response from that.
Can someone find it on 360 North? In other words, are there archived resources, or are there shows on demand on 360 North if you miss something?
There is a separate anniversary, Marine Highway anniversary page at 360north.org. You'll go and you'll see a little banner. The full programs aren't on there yet, but there are snippets of the programs. There's behind-the-scenes information. You can see some of the film crew working, images. You can see them trying to do some aerial photography and various things, and some things that worked and some things that didn't work. So it's a fun resource to go to. The entire program will not be on video on demand for a while. They all have to be broadcast first, and there's other things to get out of the way. But you can get more information about it, and the other programs will be advertising it pretty heavily because folks all around Alaska are asking about the series.
And 360 North is on the web, is that right?
We're streamed online, so anything that you can watch on television, you can also watch any place where you can get an internet connection, so we're sort of worldwide in that way.
Thanks so much, Tim. We appreciate about the information as to what's coming up on 360 North and the four-part documentary on the Marine Highway System. Sounds something very exciting to look forward
Thanks.
To. Tomorrow afternoon on A Juno Afternoon, Shona Strasser will host. We'll get a preview of this month's Southeast Alaska State Fair from guest Jessica Edwards and Haynes. We'll hear a profile of DJ Astronomar, produced by Annie Bartholomew. Lena Simmons and Scarlett McAdam will update us on Juno Lyric Opera activities, and Catherine Hatch will be here with Arts Up. That's Writer's Almanac, Music, and More tomorrow at 3 on KTOO. If you miss a Juno afternoon or want to listen again, you can catch it and other local, statewide, national, and international news at KTOO.org. Don't forget the documentary Tonight, produced by the kids in the Kinney Lake School District at 8 p.m. on the history of the Kennecott mining. Whether it will include, it does include, and you can see it right now, decreasing clouds outside, lovely for this evening, but partly cloudy with scattered showers over the next couple of days. This is KTOO FM in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, tuned to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens at K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI cable on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872 and KXLL at 873. We're also online at www.ktoo.org. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.